Welcome to the Docs Who Lift podcast, where we distill and simplify the complexities of a healthy lifestyle, exercise, medicine, and weight loss. We're excited to bring you a podcast that's a prescription for clinical practice, scientific recommendations, and just real life. This is the Docs Who Lift podcast.
Hey, welcome back to the Docs Who Lift podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Spencer Nadolski, with my co-host, Dr. Carl. And we have a very cool guest today. We always say they're the specialist guest we've ever had, but he's great. Dr. Josh Umber, a family doctor who has been one of the pioneers of this direct primary care movement, which I absolutely love. So we're going to have him here to school us on all things insurance and direct pay models. With my brother being an endocrinologist, so he's a specialist, we always wonder, how does that fit into this type of model? So welcome, Dr. Josh.
Yeah, great intro there. You guys need to have like Optimus Prime read off.
This is
Optimus Prime.
you must be definitely one of us. We just tried to get the Transformers protein powder from Core Nutrition to sponsor us, but I think we're gonna have to do that in 2025. But I did get some free stuff. So
pretty excited. Free protein powder. There you go.
Be the perfect voice for the intro. Yeah.
Very good. So how did you when did you graduate medical school and residency and all that stuff?
Graduated med school 2007, residency 2010, and then opened our practice right out of 2 months after graduating residency.
Oh, so I graduated
pretty similar to me.
Yeah, So you're a little bit. I graduated residency in 2014. So yeah, we're not that far off. You're right around where my brother is.
I graduated residency in 2011 with internal medicine. Okay. Right. Yeah.
And so during residency, you followed the traditional. Obviously, they don't do direct pay in residency. You followed the usual insurance model, and then you went right away into direct pay?
Oh, yeah. I knew from undergrad that we were going to do the direct pay model. So that's going amazing. All the way back to like 2000.
Wow. Where did you go to undergrad?
K-State.
Oh.
Kent State University.
Yeah.
But the origin story of sorts is growing up, my dad was a trash man. He's a lawyer now, so we still tell people he's a trash man because it's less embarrassing. but he's actually our lawyer now, and so even better. And thanks to his hard work, I've never had a speeding ticket. But he had a great business for 20 years until he went back to school and sold it. And so I'll joke, it was the original membership concierge model. You paid once a month. We picked up once a week. Why did you need to complicate that anymore? And then as a pre-med, I started working for a plastic surgeon who was fresh out of training. And watching that sausage get made, he was a brilliant cutter. I put together his board application packet and, you know, his complex surgeries and stuff. He was amazing and made probably less money as a private practice plastic surgeon than he did as a resident because no one taught him how to bill insurance. Right. Mm-hmm. Google was in its infancy against 2000. We were figuring out everything on our own, and they would just lowball him or pile up the administration, and he wouldn't get paid. And so I could see that ridiculousness, emperor's new clothes type situation of, well, I know how a good business has been run, and I'll go look for businesses like that. And so I did and participated with insurance free clinics that were more fee for service or as part of the American, I forget the exact name of the group, Concierge Association of America, for 10 years. And they struggled. They went through several name changes, but 95% of concierge doctors going through that decade failed because most were trying to be the 25,000 per person per year model.
Oh yeah.
And the business model, I think, really wasn't tweaked out as well as it is now. But so we watched a lot of doctors struggle, and the more they struggled, the more it just kind of told other docs, well, see one, do one, teach one. They tried something different. It didn't work. So there must not be any option. We took all of what we learned there and said, we've got to make an affordable model for the masses, both for patients and for doctors. And hopefully that's where we're at.
Okay. Could you explain the traditional insurance model, just the fee-for-service insurance model, and then how that compares to this kind of new, well, somewhat new direct pay model?
Yeah. I think the idea is the faulty assumption that is at the foundation of an insurance-based model is that healthcare is expensive. And then how do we manage expensive things? We try to insure them. And that makes perfect sense for car, home, auto, life, et cetera, or at least in the ways that we use those. And then we use the tool of insurance wrong when it comes to healthcare. You can't find another product like healthcare, health insurance. As I say, you know, a wrench makes a pretty decent hammer, but a hammer makes a horrible wrench. It's just wrong tool for the wrong job. The idea that you'll have people use their insurance for regular things, blood pressure, strep throat, allergies, that the doctors will play this paperwork game. They won't bill the patient. They will bill the insurance. Now you have this cold war between, well, insurance will pay more, but only if you document more. Mm-hmm. But then, all right, but if we document more, we spend less time with the patient. Mm-hmm. Now we need more staff to do more billing, so then we see more patients and then have less time to do the, and insurance is just kind of creeps it up. And I really blame doctors more than I blame insurance companies. One, we've blamed insurance and government for forever, and that hasn't changed anything. And two, you know, we have a lot more control in the process than I think we give ourselves credit for. But even when they, the architects of Medicare went out and we're researching clinics a year after Medicare actually launched, and we're shocked to see how different clinics were operating from before and after Medicare, because they set a set of rules that they thought were going to match how doctors practiced before Medicare. And then when you change the rules to the game, you play the game differently. Now suddenly you weren't pre-Medicare, you weren't reimbursed for checking boxes, so you just didn't feel the need. After Medicare came out, you did get paid more for checking more boxes, so docs did it more. And you know, kind of the great law of unintended consequences, they weren't expecting docs to change the practice to maximize their billing. And ever since, it's just been this cold war of we'll play your game better, so you have to pay us more, so we change the rules to the game. And now you have doctors seeing 30, 40, 50 people a day for 7 minutes, buffing the chart, doing digital care to make sure they hit guideline requirements, whether or not that ends up being the right thing to do for the patient in front of them. And not only are doctors burnt out, patients aren't happy, employers aren't happy. It's really not working out well for anybody except maybe insurance companies. And we just kind of keep doing it, which I find interesting on lots of levels. The direct care model, you referenced the new version of it. One of my favorite quotes from a TED Talk is, if you want a new idea, read an old book. And Dr. Christy Ford Chapin is a healthcare economic historian from Oxford, has a book on this, I think, The Social Transformation of Medicine. And she talks about how 1920s and 30s, now we have to add the 19, is exactly how they did it, right? Health insurance for healthcare was a product of the world wars. And before that, they paid cash, and they paid membership cash. And she talks about from an economic standpoint how a membership is sort of beautifully self-balancing. If you charge too much and do too little, there's no incentive to join. If you mm-hmm. do too much and charge too little, you may not be profitable. And even so far as these clinics in the 20s would bring in specialists for free because they wanted their brand of clinic to be known as able to take care of sick people in complicated cases, because yeah, only a fraction of people are that sick and that complicated, but everyone worries they might be. So you had to go above and beyond for sick people to earn the healthy customers. And then how far we've come from that. So direct care in a lot of ways is getting back to the roots, or Marcus Welby with an iPhone.
That's here's great. A question, I guess, then, because I think a lot of, from my perspective, so you talked about how you blame doctors more than insurance. I always talk about how I blame insurance for how they do this, because, yeah, I know other, I know primary care doctors and endocrinologists, even, unfortunately, who, you know how to get the most bang for the buck from the insurance and, you know, both the big government insurance and just big commercial insurance, because the incentives are wrong nowadays. You know, so the fee for service in the insurance model, yeah, we could see 40 patients a day provide shitty care, but get paid way more. And I, you know, I think that's part of the reason why, you know, my current smaller community hospital is going to drop our specialty, because, you know, in endocrinology, we have complex patients who require time. They also require resources, dietitians, nurse on the phone, that sort of thing. That's what we had. And, you know, and we don't want to be just a mill where we churn and burn through patients. So, but that's how the insurance model has always incentivized, whether they meant to or not. I understand that's probably not what they meant to do, because doesn't this go back to those days where things have changed? Now we need to hit more of the chronic disease model, and that's part of the problem? Or am I just talking trash and I don't know what I'm talking about?
Maybe both.
Yeah, definitely the trash.
In the sense that, I don't think any system that's not working was necessarily meant for that, right? Like, was it Hansen's law? Don't assume malice where ignorance would suffice. Mm-hmm. Is they're not bad, they're bad at it. Yeah. And they're playing within the confines of a game that was broken from the start. You're mm-hmm. insuring something that's an actuarial risk. You have to manage for that, and then, but they're not in control of the price, and you don't insure frequent things because you can't control the price. Same reason we don't have car insurance for gasoline. We don't have homeowners insurance for lawn care, and we don't have life insurance for groceries. All of those things are relevant, but you don't insure those. As soon as a third-party payer comes in, you lose that balance of economics. And they didn't, per Dr. Chapin's book, they didn't want to be in this space because they knew that was the moral hazard. This is not an actuarial issue. So you can't have actuarial principles applied to control the usage. Now it's just how do you control the burn the best you can every year, knowing that, you know, roughly, generically, 80% of people aren't going to use their insurance much in a given year, not enough to hit their deductible. So you have to make them happy, but you have to charge so little that they stay in the game, but keep enough money that you can take care of the 20% who are really sick. And this gets into, you know, stuff we're just not trained for. There's a fantastic book on this, A Risky Business, Why Insurance Companies Fail and What to Do About It. And it's all risk selection. And so we keep raising the price of insurance and we keep losing the healthy people. And then we wonder why health insurance isn't affordable. Mm-hmm. But the part of blaming doctors is, you know, back to your scenario with the clinic. I don't think doctors are bad, of course. I think they're not playing the game correctly, but it's an unwinnable game. It's heads mm-hmm. I lose, tails you win. Is either A, you see 40 people a day and provide the best care you can, because no one's intentionally providing bad care, I think, or we'll at least steel man that assumption. And versus straw man, you know, we'll give them the benefit of the doubt, but you still have got to go home and eat. You still have financial pressures, and docs are bad with money, and we don't make any money until we're in our early 30s, and we have tons of debt, and med school and residency doesn't know how to teach us about that. So we come out very educated on medicine and not very educated on finances, and we worry about that. And so then forced between your family not eating as well and being a martyr, or and you taking more time with patients, I mean, something's got to give. The great solution is always, I think, somewhat obvious and somewhat hard. I like these two examples, whether or not they're true, it doesn't necessarily matter. Christopher Columbus's egg and Napoleon's aluminum. Christopher Columbus sailed the world, came back, you know, hey, it's round. They're like, yeah, we kind of already thought so. You're not special. So he takes the an egg and asks all the king's horses and all the king's men to try to make the egg balance. And of course, you can't make an egg balance. It's not built for that. He takes the egg, crunches the bottom, egg stands up. Right. I didn't say you couldn't do anything to the egg. Why didn't anybody think outside of the egg and do this, right? And it took something impossible to possible. So possible, it's benignly simple. We're teaching calculus to fifth graders here, right? Like this. And then Napoleon's aluminum was so hard to come by and purify that if he wanted to impress dignitaries, generals ate off silver, he ate off gold, and they ate off aluminum. And now we have, you know, aluminum foil we throw away because of, you know, good technology. And we got to sort of learn these things and say, look, if we have new ideas and new technology, we can take healthcare that was crappy in 7 minutes and didn't pay well and was expensive to insure. And believe it or not, we can actually make that, you know, 10 patients a day and 45 minutes each and cheaper for the patient, cheaper for the insurance, and more profitable for the doctor, right? Like those, all those things shouldn't make sense, but I have a supercomputer on my wrist. We're talking on supercomputers that fit in our pockets with supercomputers that fit in my ears. And we think that, you know, with a private space race between billionaires, they're like, we'll go to space, but you can't fix healthcare, right? Ridiculous on some front. So we have to think outside of that box and say, actually, if we break it down to first principles and take care of the patient, there are very sort of easy, well, very clear solutions. It might be a difficult solution to get to, but the path, the vision is clear.
So how have you done this? Because I'll before you answer, in residency, I just posted about this today. There was a memory from Facebook 8 years ago where I was like, our system's archaic. I remember 2011 I was an intern and just being like, I want to give lifestyle guidance to these people. I want to learn about them. I want to get to know these patients well. I don't want 7 minutes. They give us 20-minute appointments. The first 10 minutes was the medical assistant getting all the vitals and everything like that. And then I'd have like 10, maybe 15 minutes with the patient to go over things and somehow give them lifestyle guidance. And I was like, this is insane. And then we got to learn about coding and billing and then have the coders and billers help us. And we're paying them, just like you said, to try to maximize our reimbursement, and to then only have the insurances sometimes go, we don't feel like giving you the money this time, just for whatever reason, almost because it's a blue moon. So how did you do it? What is the system? I follow you on Twitter. I just, what you say resonates, if you and a few others, about how, like, yeah, like you said before, we don't use our car insurance for new windshield wiper blades or whatever else, new brakes. We use it if we get in a car accident. So how is your system? Like, what did you do?
And I'd like to make sure you guys clarify that. So Spencer, you're talking about, you are a family medicine resident and right, going right into family medicine, and same with you, right? You're a family medicine. So I want to make sure we clarify that, as, because again, I'm here to learn people, not to make out with you. Go on with the chlorophyll.
I would say the answer here is the same for endocrinology. I put that on the spectrum of chronic care specialties. So the model almost doesn't change at all. We can have an interesting discussion about pricing, but back of the envelope math is, it's very easy. You have plenty of patients that need chronic care, routine labs, routine meds, et cetera, whether that's family medicine or endocrinology. And I think the interesting answer to a lot of things is backwards, and the tendency between, I think, school and just how we're built is, if somebody asks you a question, say, what more can I do, as opposed to, should I even be doing that, right? And per TikTok and ChatGPT, I'm going to trust that this is true, is Michelangelo's David was such a giant piece of stone that they dug out 40 years prior, and several different artists, sculptors had worked on it, and no one thought they could get something from it. And he saw, you know, the David in the stone, but it's designed by subtraction. It's what you remove. It's Apple removing all these things to make it just work. The answer isn't more insurance, and that's part of the problem is we keep trying to answer it that way. If you ask a doctor how to improve their clinic or something, I think most will say, well, the patients with the best insurance pay me, you know, I get reimbursed the most there. So if everybody had great insurance, I'd get reimbursed well on everyone, and I could see fewer patients and spend more time with them. But again, that's a sledgehammer for a scalpel solution. It's smart dumb. It works, but then you have no money left over for anything else. The reality is, like Elon says, optimize, automate, eliminate. The solution is removing. Less red tape, less processes, less everything. You know, for $50 a month to 600 patients, you'd probably make more than you're making now with one staff member, no insurance, unlimited visits, hour-long visits, wholesale meds, wholesale labs, et cetera. And that's just the back of the envelope math. Raise that 10 bucks, and that's another $72,000 a year, and $60 a month is still pretty affordable. So, and I think because doctors don't read about business, they don't study things outside of our group, it makes us very vulnerable to bad ideas. Most bad ideas have been tried somewhere else, some other industry. But I think Churchill or somebody said, you know, learn from the mistakes. They just don't have to be your mistakes. Well, when pay for performance, this will, you know, A1Cs for endocrinology, makes no sense in actuality, but sounds great to administrator. We'll mm-hmm. pay you more money if you take better care of patients. They did this in schools, and they said, hey, teachers, if the kids get more A's, we'll pay you more money. What do you think happened?
Right. This is, that's a great analogy for the whole A1C thing, because we can make people have good sugars. It doesn't mean we're doing it the right way. And right. that actually results in better outcomes for the patients listening out there. That's what he's referring to. We can make your A1C good.
Well, or we can make our average good, which is mm-hmm. usually what they're doing, right? I can order more A1Cs on healthy people who don't need it. I can stop ordering A1Cs on my really sick people who do need it. I can just fire the 5% mm-hmm. who need help the most, but throw my numbers up. But again, it's a heads exactly. I lose, tails you win model. So this goes back to Jeff Foxworthy. You remember him?
Mm-hmm.
You might be a redneck.
Yeah.
He had this great bit where a cop goes up to a guy and says, hey, I got to repossess your car. Unless you can give me $500 cash. And the guy says, $500 cash? Who's got that kind of money? And the cop says, well, could you write me a check? And the guy says, check? Hell, I thought you wanted money. Sure, I'll pay the whole thing off right now. You know? And so this book, Tyranny of Metrics, is perfect for healthcare because what we ask for and what we measure are entirely different things. Oh, I'll give you a check. I'll give you lower A1Cs averaged out across my clinic. Oh, you wanted cash. You wanted the sick people to get more time and attention and make them healthier. Well, I wasn't incentivized for that, right? Mm-hmm. So we end up playing all these games, and it's only because insurance is paying. If you were responsible to the patient, then ultimately it magically aligns really quickly. What does the patient want and need out of this? How can I do the best care for them to keep them coming back? And that's a little different for everybody. But when an A1C is $2 and not $100, and this is what I find so fascinating and frustrating about medicine and how we're taught, is we're taught the pathology of psych, not the application of psych. So we do an A1C every 3 months because...
Are you asking me personally?
Yeah, well, I mean, you just... Well,
it depends on the person, well, but I mean, well, the insurance companies mandate it a lot. because the A1Cs are a three-month marker. So we tell patients that their red blood cells live 3 months, and so they're basically a three-month estimated marker of your average blood sugar. Yeah.
Which is like the absolute best nerdy doctor answer. Right. Like that's the correct answer. And then we got insurance to pay off the correct answer. And I think that's dumb. Right. Yeah. Because the lifespan of the red blood cell has little to nothing to do with the psychology of how we change patient behavior. Right. We're focusing on the illness, not the person. And if you're focusing on the person, then you do A1Cs every month because You know, what the psychology of change and pattern and behavior and things tells us is, boy, if you only talk to them every, you know, four times a year about their A1C, you're going to only have four times to change. If we do it every month, then I have 12 times a year to talk to them and get that down and make adjustments. And if it's $100, sure, you do it four times a year. If it's $2, I'm doing more care more often for less money and getting better results faster, easier, with less paperwork, no insurance, less hassle, and happier patients. What's not to love, right? So I think we tend to, doctors look at, and we've seen this on X, we get told there's a problem, we answer it like a multiple choice question. Instead of having honed this, if someone comes in, maybe this is more for family medicine, you know, oh, doc, I got a migraine, I'm grabbing the back of my neck. We're like, well, that's probably a tension headache or something else, but let me ask a series of questions. But we don't apply that to the medical or the business problem. Well, why do we only check a blood test or something so often? What if it was cheaper? We stick to these assumptions that everything is broken and hard and expensive, but in part because we're so busy being head down taking care of 30 to 40 patients. So until you kind of can pull away from that and see the bigger picture, then you start to see the David come out of the stone and realize, holy shit, if meds are just $2, I'll do a whole lot more meds. I don't even have to be good, right? I'll just Mayo Clinic this shit and just do a whole bunch, right? How many times have you guessed a hyperthyroid patient just off symptoms alone, right?
The problem is it's a selection bias. They're already referred. They're already referred. So I already know.
Yeah.
You know, well, that's really, the other brother. For the most part. But
I did the work for you.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't know. I mean, this could go get down some deep rabbit
hole. I want to know. I want to know. I want to know his exact how, like, what is your clinic? What is your whole system?
And I want to know it in a family practice model we'll talk about endocrine and you know, CGM and A1C and all the other consulting stuff.
I want Dr. Josh Umber as a doctor. What does that look like?
Well, I mean, like, we'll talk the broader model. Yeah. I mean, but what it was we were in the emperor's new clothes. The kid who spots the naked emperor is the blind fool, or the wise fool, I think they call it. I was the wise fool. I was just a dumb undergrad kid who had no family in medicine, never really been in it before, liked it because I liked lifting weights too, and kind of went down that path. And so once you could see, it was obvious how broken it was. And so I think that's where med students are now. There is no specific connection to one model or another. And so he said, well, why are those meds expensive? Well, who buys them? Right. The Toyota asked five whys thing. I think I just more stumbled into it of, well, I don't know. What's the pharmacy's markup on those meds? Well, I don't know. Where does the pharmacy get those meds? Well, I don't know. What's the manufacturer sell them to, you know? And eventually you talk to enough people, because I would ask that all through med school, well, what's a strep throat culture cost? Every doctor, you know, just I don't know. We already are required to know so many things, and the price changes for every insurance in the hospital. Everything is set up in the system for doctors to fail when it comes to knowing pricing. But when you realize, no, a strep throat swab, just the CLIA wave, it's, you know, about $1 a piece. Well, why are we billing insurance? Well, because insurance didn't pay us for something else. And an EKG, the sticky pads, 10 sticky pads for a 12 lead EKG, right? It 3 or 4 cents each. So give or take 40 cents. Why do we bill $100 for an EKG? Because we can, because it's this rat race. And we just do what everyone else did, see one, do one, teach one in medicine. We just, I think we're dumb enough to come in, and we had never run a clinic before. We had no idea how to do it, but we saw everyone who was doing it hated it. And so we'll just do it different. You know, by the time when I started intern year, the graduating third years, you know, leading into the real world, by the time I'm a graduating third year, half of those docs were quitting medicine because of burnout. So, well, that was an obvious bad path. No one knows what this is, but it can't be as bad as that. So, and that was just it. We, like how we stumbled across wholesale labs. I was with a pediatrician on rotation as a resident. She was filling out actual paperwork, right? Carbon copy, triplicate forms. There were several boxes: bill to patient, bill to doctor, bill to insurance. And I said, well, what does bill to doctor mean? Her exact words were, I don't know, in 20 years, I've never checked that box. part of the problem with how we're taught is we are not taught what to think or how to think. We're taught what to think, which it makes sense. We don't need to all reinvent the Krebs cycle, but it's there needs to be a tinge of pirate in there, or asking questions or figuring out stuff, not just regurgitating. So I took that. I called the lab. I pretended my attending gave me an assignment and, you know, what does this mean? And they're like, oh, if you set up an account with us, we get a 95% discount to you. You know, it's a literal jaw-dropping moment. Why? Well, I don't know. Could you go and bill insurance for it? So if they just get cash up front, that's the true cost of care. We keep trying to fix, well, why are labs expensive? And we never actually got to the real heart of the problem because we just took that at, you know, face value as a multiple choice doctor question. Then just that part alone is 30% labs and meds, 30 to 40% of everything insurance pays for. Right. So then the same thing, like, well, talk to enough people and you realize the pharmacists are buying wholesale meds, the independent ones. Most of the big box ones aren't in control of that. And sure shit, 44 states allow doctors to dispense meds. Well, we dispense lidocaine in our office and IV fluids and Zofran and Fenugreek and flu shots and everything. They just, no one ever thought to take it one step further. Right. In all due respect to my pharmacy colleagues, you know, licenses at the top. The hard part is in picking the med, knowing the side effects, the diagnosis, all that. Counting it is fairly straightforward. And so then you realize, holy shit, same thing. I mean, I can get, you know, 1,000 amlodipine for $12. It used to be $8, right? We have, if Walmart has a $4 a month list, we have a $4 a year list. Now, granted, it's not large, but hard to buy 365 of something. And so I did that once. I was in DC forever ago, meeting with the head of HHS, Dr. Tom Price. And there's this big pharmacy round table of, you know, how to do this. And they were all actually arguing for higher prices. It seems like all my references are endocrinology now. They said every dollar spent at the pharmacy saved, $7 downstream for diabetic care. Okay. Maybe. So their argument was to spend more at the pharmacy, raise the pharmacy prices to save more downstream. No, 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 that's not paying $1 for metformin, saving $7 downstream. That's just because you pay $2 for metformin doesn't mean it saves $14, right? No, it still saves $7. So we got around to Tom and he asked what we asked. I'm a family doctor. I dispense wholesale meds for a penny a pill. And I shut up. And that got him to ask questions. And he's like, so my simvastatin, what would that? I was like, $365. He goes, oh, a month? That's nice. I said, oh, a year. Right. It's this, it's so broken. Everybody knows healthcare is broken. But once they actually hear the solution, it's almost a little jarring that it's that broken. Right. Like I got that hard. Right. That, you know, this is that easy. And then, you know, so you start to realize the removing of the business model is the secret sauce. As long as you guarantee that subscription payment, it solves all kinds of problems. The guarantee, I mean, as long as you have it, I don't have to have a different price for viral, pharyngitis, bacterial, fungal, unknown, et cetera. In the same way that Netflix didn't have a different price for every genre. Blockbuster was making 16% of their profit or $800 million a year on late fees because they could, but also because they had to, because they can't sell that DVD again if you don't bring it back. So they're going to make sure they at least get the profit margin if you of a lost visit. Netflix being by mail or digital was so different, they could eliminate that. And the only reason we have late fees in medicine is, understandably, it's the insurance saying we just need a buffer so you don't go spend $150 of our money without you spending 20 of yours. We're okay if you do. We can write a plan that has no co-pays. It's just a higher premium. Oh, you don't want the higher premium? Okay, then we build this back in. And that's, you know, for to cover all the customers. But as you start to understand that, you can say, look, if I have $50 down 600 patients, I'm it. That's it. I'm good. I don't need any more. Right, I can charge a little more, I can see more patients, but I don't need any insurance. And then you start adding all these values. So if Toyota has five whys for problem solving, I like to think direct care has the five ands of marketing. Unlimited visits and no copays and free procedures and wholesale meds and wholesale labs and free cheap online specialty consultants and et cetera. Right. And so it's, you know, you guys are gym bros. The gym that has an enrollment fee, everyone hates that. And no gym has a copay, right? The heaviest thing in the gym is the front door. So they're not trying to keep you from coming in, but healthcare does. So as you broke down all these business models, the you know, direct care model just was the David in the stone.
Okay. So how does this look exactly like with your price? So if I'm just a Joe Schmo, 50-year-old guy, used to going to my PCP, it takes me 3 to 6 months to get into the PCP
or
whatever.
And you have insurance, right? Because you have to have insurance for whatever, yeah.
And you go for your physical once a year, you have whatever ailments that you're trying to see them for. It takes a while to get in, takes a while to get a message back if you send them a message, maybe 3 or 4 days. And they usually say, hey, you got to come in to discuss this. So instead, you pay us some sort of, you know, just like Netflix, a subscription fee, whether it's 50, 100 or so bucks. You can then come see you whenever or message you whenever. You can get labs instead of – so a lipid panel, I don't know what insurance or how much it would cost. But like, you know, when I look into it, it's like $1 or $2 for the wholesale cost, whatever it is. So you can use your insurance, I suppose, but like – or you could just like pay 10 bucks for all the labs that you'd ever need that one time.
That you ever need. I mean, this is going to get into the specialty stuff, but continue on for primary care because this is where I get nervous.
Yeah. Like – so and then like, okay, for example, I was worried my kid had strep the other day and I'm like, why don't I have my own little, and I can't find them. I'm going to have to ask you. I want my own little strep kit. Amazon. I was looking, I'll have to ask you offline, yeah. But, cause you can get now COVID flu, tests and it'll tell you within,
or whoever your supplier is, and probably whoever sells you gloves will probably sell you. Yeah.
Yeah, that's what I want. And but like, I feel like everybody should have these things at such low cost. And so that you can then just make it so much more. It's not even about the cost as much. It's so much more efficient too. Like right. It's just archaic to take a half day off of work to bring your kid to the doctor and then wait, whatever. I don't know.
If you thought it was a service industry, I mean, Amazon is trying to deliver same day. Right. And they're doing a better job of that than doctors are. And in part because the doctor only gets reimbursed more or less, except COVID televisit type stuff, if you walk through their door. So again, back to we're the smartest dumb people I can think of, because for how many decades did we bring people to the office during flu season to see if they had flu?
Yeah, that's right. Terrible.
Because that's the way we got paid. We never bucked that system. That we never said, like, you're infectious. Let's not bring infectious people to the office.
I hated that.
To be around non-infect, or at least have a system for keeping them away from it, whatever.
Terrible.
Right.
Terrible.
Because we stopped.
Giving me PTSD, man.
Right. Oh, my. So the value proposition is unlimited visits, home visits, office visits, technology visits, calling, texting, email, video. No copays. Any procedure we can do in the office is free of charge. Stitches, biopsies, joint injections, some ultrasounds, Holter monitors, DEXA, spirometry. If you know, now when you include the butterfly's got AI for real time ejection fraction, right?
That's
family
amazing.
Doctor is going to end up having this ridiculous cold war of services that we add by tech. But then wholesale meds, wholesale labs at cost plus 10%, right? To keep that easy. Then we have online doctor-to-doctor consults for, you know, $30 in a couple of hours in a day or two. You keep fixing every problem the customer might have, just like Amazon does. Once you do that, you need one full-time registered nurse, typically, per 1 to 2 doctors. Well, compared to the normal 5 to 7 for insurance billing. I've had 2 people on my schedule today. I could still see, you know, anybody who needs to come in, it's same or next day 99% of the time. But if it's next day, it's usually because it was just too late in the day and it's not urgent. We'll come in after hours and do stitches for free, you know, all the, because if I save you $1,000 ER visit, you love me. Mm-hmm. It costs me $2 or $3 in stitches that are going to expire eventually, right? And it ends up being some of the best marketing, because happy people go and tell other people.
That's right.
Like, oh my God, I got stitches for free. How'd you get stitches for free? You know, So you know, again, the psychology of connecting with people. But it's just that easy. I'd love to say we did something proprietary, but it wasn't. We're not that special. We're not that smart. Wholesale labs was already a thing. Wholesale meds were already a thing. Membership models are everywhere now. Panera has a membership model for cups, which I find for drinks hilarious, because everyone was, oh, if it's a membership, it's insurance, or you only, it's insurance if you bill at the end of the month or the beginning. None of that made any sense. Never has, never will. And so the model is really the same for endocrinology, honestly. Your you know, well-founded fear is, for any specialty, what do you do for the expensive stuff? Case by case. And the assumption is that we can't fix much, when the assumption should be there's very few things we can't fix. I generally don't recommend doing cocaine. I feel comfortable saying that on your podcast. That is my, unless you have a glioblastoma, in which case, undiagnosed, and it helps us find that because of your seizures. Then there's a small window of opportunity where cocaine is helpful. That and ER nosebleeds. So this patient, yada yada, she had that and glioblastoma. Chemotherapy was going to be $26,000 a dose, right? And this is 2013 or something. She has a neurosurgeon in my town, you know, then the tertiary hospital at the med school, a neurosurgeon, neuro-onc, social work. No one knows what anything costs. At some point, I think I'm going to go real aggressive here and say it is an ethical and public shame that every physician doesn't know what the cost of their meds are for patients. It is doing the most direct harm we can do to our patients by us not participating in that information, right? Like, I'm going to go hard on that, because we could get the same chemotherapy for her for $1,200. So when you say the family doc can't fix glioblastomas, you're not wrong, but you're not right either. You know, I still did a 90 some percent improvement on her ability to get that care, all because I know how to type, right? That should be shameful. That the neurosurgeon, the neuro-onc, the onc, the social worker should all be ashamed of themselves. And every doctor who doesn't have it, because it's free to use, even in the states where you don't dispense, just so you have the, you know, we're data-based people, and if we don't have data to help us make the decision, is name brand metformin that much better? Well, at $20 a pill, probably not. You know, generic metformin, so at a penny a pill.
What about the actual, because, you know, I mean, metformin's, you know, darn near worthless these days for most people with a significant disease. So, you know, we have a lot of these expensive medicines, you know, so when we talk about chronic patients in endocrine, you know, we have our obesity, diabetes, heart disease, heart failure, kidney disease, liver disease people, where a lot of the medical therapies, in addition to, by the way, you know, we are obviously the docs who lift, so we are very heavy, and everyone should be, and all the guidelines are heavy, despite what people out there want to say, into lifestyle medicine. And so again, yeah, the, you know, it sounds like a, you know, a membership direct care model, all that stuff can support a little bit more time for lifestyle guidance, but we also use our dietitians, and I have diabetes educators who need to spend a lot of time with people. Because we have a lot of patients and I'm the only one around, you know what I mean, for endocrinology. And so, you know, I can't get away with just 500 patients paying a certain amount of membership fee in order to help people. But we have those.
I think that the essential problem is you're starting there that you can't.
What a right. fucking martyr.
Well, I you know, I'm in the unfortunate position, unlike Spencer, where what I actually care about people.
What an asshole.
Yeah.
What an asshole.
You know, but that's what I'm trying to get at, because that's what I'm trying to figure out.
That's okay. Yeah.
So, I mean, we see 14, 16 patients a day. So we spend a lot of time with people, but we have the chronic care model patients, or the chronic patients, those obesity, cardiometabolic patients that were spending a lot of diet, exercise time, expensive medicines, continuous glucose monitors. We also have the chronic patients who have type 1 diabetes who see us. And, you know, they're spending a lot of time with our diabetes educators. They have insulin pumps. They have their CGMs. They have also, that's a whole different ballgame.
So this
God,
is what I love about this conversation.
And then I have the consulting patients that come in for very, you know, the rare endocrine stuff. And they don't need to be seen all the time. And in fact, you know, and then the simple ones like thyroid cancer, they're just getting checked out once a year. They're, you know, easy peasy most of the time, you know, relatively quick.
All right, let's let Josh answer. I want to hear Josh, Dr. Umber.
This is what I need. That is I have every patient that you just mentioned, and I'm doing right. So the problem isn't that those patients exist or that you have them. If anything, you're in a better position. Like I'm guilty of turning every bug into a feature. You say these are all the problems. I say those are all the benefits you have. Right. I have one patient with thyroid cancer, so I'm not always quite sure, you know, what the standard of care is from an so I spend more time making sure we're meeting standard of care. You know it off the back of your hand, right? I educate patients. I was a nutritionist before med school. That was my degree. And so we do education for patients with diabetes. What you're saying is you know the insurance model is broken and not working out well, but still very reluctant to say that anything else could be better.
Not necessarily. I just know the patients feel that way because I talk to them all the time, especially as we're making this transition. I haven't had any patients say that they wouldn't want it. They're all desperately saying, oh, I hope my insurance covers it. And I'm like, well, we're working on it. And maybe we'll have two different, a hybrid model. So I am desperately wanting to learn how to do what you're talking about. Cause in my heart, I feel like it's gotta be better for patients, but I feel like we're almost like, it's like a vicious cycle. We're everyone's so damn dependent on insurance that they can't get away from it.
I'm not sure which movie to quote.
Like Dumb and Dumber down or... and use HSAs and direct care, which I, to be honest, does sound better to me. I just can't figure out how to get patients to, acknowledge that too.
Insurance is a good tool. And I think that's worth saying is we get typecast as like we're anti-insurance in everything we do. No, insurance when designed well is probably the best way to take care of stuff. But we also have to appreciate that health insurance is actually financial insurance, right? It's not providing anything other than covering, the cost of care. It's not making the diagnosis. It's not training the patient. It's not doing anything. Might pay for some of those, but, Ryan Holiday book, The Obstacle is the Way. You're stuck on this obstacle that I need all these dietitians. But if you had to, you'd find a way that's better than that. My College of Human Nutrition had the dietitians in it. They do good work. At the same time, if you had to scale it, there is a way where you'd scale that, and then we can talk about it. But you already have patients. Some of their care is expensive. Some of it would go through insurance. That is just as true in family medicine, if not more so, because you're seeing your 20% of endocrinology that's expensive. I'm seeing the 20% of every specialty that's expensive too, right? Even if they go to the specialist, they come back to me and say, do I really need to be on Januvia for, congestive heart failure, post-MI, yes, no, maybe.
Hope not.
Absolute risk, reduction versus relative risk reduction, et cetera. But it's there.
You mean Jardiance?
Jardiance, thank you. Yeah.
Yeah. So that's an interesting point. So these medicines that they're expensive, and now we're going down a rabbit hole. But so, are you basically saying, would you then not necessarily have people do what statistically has been shown to reduce the risk of heart attacks, heart failure, and kidney disease because it's cheaper to not do that? I don't want to misinterpret what you just said.
Let's take the worst version of that argument for the sake of the argument and say yes. So, but then to not dive into the particulars of any one medicine, let's propose a scenario. A 1% risk reduction in a bad outcome, and it costs more than your mortgage. What do you do? Right. You skip the medicine. And I think that's the reality that we're up against is as we get farther and farther, we sort of forget we're in the miracle age of medicine because our blockbuster meds are generic now, right? Crestor, a 56% reduction in LDL for a nickel a day. Yeah, everybody should be on Crestor. It should be in the water, right? And so Viagra thinks that we're $100 a pill. But there's studies to show that I really do think it'll end up being somewhat significant. But this is a soft take. Studies to show that it decreased dementia. And it decreased Cialis decreased heart attack by 40%, congestive heart failure by 35%, and all-cause mortality by 32%. So your wife won't kill you as often if you have Cialis, but it's blood flow, right? It's opening up blood vessels, which means, you know, healthy arteries, healthy organs. That being said, it was unattainable for most people when it came out in cost. And now the capitalism brings the comforts of kings to commoners. It's 4 cents a day. If you need it, it's there. What we're going to find is Jardiance worth that much? You know, once it's generic, oh, probably. But sure. You do run into those very real scenarios. That's what insurance is really good at, though, is covering expensive things. The inverse of that is, would I tell someone not to be hospitalized if they need to be, regardless of, no. But that's why we insure hospitalizations. It's very rare. It's very unpredictable, et cetera. So we're constantly being forced with that decision. It's just whether or not you let insurance make that decision for you, or you have that conversation directly with the patients.
So Spencer's got to quit prescribing. I guess this busts down your whole GLP clinic that you want to have online.
No, that's the thing. Insurance will pay for some of those people.
You're ruining everyone's. You're making us all go broke.
Let's not talk about GLP-1s,
Lily Direct.
but a very real example of a patient I know right now in insurance renewal of a local company that is having to let employees go because the cost of health insurance premiums, not from GLP-1s, went up so high. It went from $14,000 a year to $84,000 a year. So it's sort of funny, and I'll laugh at anything kind of guy. But it's a very real scenario where the ridiculous of physicians just leaning on newest, best, most expensive medicine and throwing out any of the other math people lost their jobs because physicians prescribed name brand medicines that there were affordable alternatives for. And insurance paid it because it was on the list. And now nobody will have access to care. That's a real situation I'm seeing. In my clinic this week. So
this
we
is
do
what
have
Spencer
to take
and I
these
thought
things
about,
into context.
I think that's, yeah.
So what totally. About with Kate? But what about for you? You don't have to have those type 2 diabetes or even type 1 diabetes patients back. You could charge a membership fee, have your CGM data online and text them things as opposed to just...
Right. And that we do want to do that. Don't get me wrong. This is where it is perfect.
Who cares about the insurance? Yeah. So just have those people...
I'm telling you, this is where... And we almost need to have like patients on now after listening to this. I want to hear from the patients because I'm telling you, they say... Well, hey, all right. As long as my insurance covers it, and it always ends up coming back to insurance. They don't.
But how do you get them to
change?
Yeah, but how do you get them to change? Because I think that's a societal cultural issue.
Right. This is a bigger picture.
Two economic books: predictably irrational behavior economics, and you go back to classic Henry Ford. If I asked the customer what they wanted, they would have said a faster horse. Somebody has to predict the solution. And I'm all first principles, hashtag put patients first, et cetera. But in all due respect, they rarely have the information necessary to see the whole picture. Not even all doctors have all the information necessary to see the whole picture. What they want is affordable care. You break first principles down. They don't need insurance to pay for it. But if we don't fix it, insurance can't lower the price of insurance until we lower the price of care. So is it going to be easy? No. 15 years ago, this was incredibly hard. It's still hard, but now it's growing 30% a year over year. You know, roughly we went from less than what I would really say 10 direct care practices in the country, probably less than 5 when I started. True direct care, doing what we do, not just concierge, et cetera, to 1,600 now, just on our platform, right? It took Starbucks 17 years to get 16 stores, right? At this pace, technically, we're outgrowing Starbucks by 100-fold, right? It's all relative. But the how do you get patients to be able to afford their Jardia? No, Jardiance.
Wegovy, Zepbound.
Well, Mujero. So what you do is you fix your insurance.
It's different.
You make so much care so affordable that their insurance isn't $25,500 a year, right? Up $1,000 a year. So next year is going to be averaging $26,500 a year, right? You make it average $5,000 a year, and they have their money back in their pocket to decide how they spend it. And then that means there's money back for everything in health, whether they're paying off medical bills, that's calling credit card bills, causing depression, anxiety, fatigue, insomnia, et cetera, right? That's real money helping real people. But then what you'd see is a fix in the market. The only reason some of these meds are expensive is the third party system, where they do get it. Work over, you know, have the leverage on your insurance company to get them to pay more. There's a reason name brand Tylenol is only slightly more than generic Tylenol. And I'd wager that Johnson & Johnson has like PhD level knowledge on by zip code, by economic standard, how much more can they, what is that perfect scenario? You get too high, you don't need name brand Tylenol, right? So right. They know they have a product. We'd have every steroid inhaler available at an affordable price if insurance wasn't propping that up, right? Right. You got to almost get insurance to quit paying for some of that stuff to let the market come in, right? And then what you see is when I have to explain to the patient what the true cost of their medicine is, well, we can do Air Duo for $40 wholesale, or with a coupon at the, or you can do Symbicort for $300 a month. You know, is one much better than another? Okay, we'll make these decisions together, but we saved you 30 to 60% on your insurance premiums. So your ultimate question kind of comes back to something we say, spend $50 a month on direct care to save $500 a month on your insurance. But if you saved $1,000 or $1,500 a month on your insurance, then, again, you're actually putting the patient back in control. Working for insurance premiums is still never going to be as efficient as directly paying for it.
Yeah. Well, drug costs also have to stay up because they got to pay for their commercials, and those are expensive here.
And the PBMs, the middlemen.
Yeah. So PBMs and commercials on TV are very expensive. So the drug companies have to keep the prices up.
I say bullshit to the drug commercial part and bullshit to the PBMs. The only reason PBMs are in effect is because docs haven't killed them. If every doc dispensed wholesale meds and they could be doing that by the end of the month, then PBMs would go out of business overnight.
How do you deal with the new brand names? So that's what I asked you online. Like, because to me, like the Lilly Direct is great, but like GLP-1, like
if expensive. I want to do wholesale. So the markup on name brand meds is next to nothing relatively. So you could still order them. They're just expensive, right? But they'd go down if insurance wasn't propping that price up. But also, we can't just focus on the expensive meds, right? Because 95% of the meds that cause your insurance to be expensive are your daily meds, right? Even at the height of the GLP-1s in the last year or two, it only raised average insurance premiums 2%. Now, 2% is a lot out of 10%, but it is not the major crux of the problem. Even all cancer care, chemo, radiation, surgery, radiology, et cetera, 5% of the average national spend, right? So we still fix the bulk of stuff, and this is where doctors get a tunnel vision on the wrong problem. No one's saying, Ford, stop marketing on TV, your cars are too expensive, and that's why. Like, is it good? Plus or minus on that. Is it a First Amendment issue? Who cares? Is it patient education on things they wouldn't otherwise know about? Maybe. But let them lose their money on it if they want to. It's still not going to change anything necessarily. Then they'll just have to find another more cost, more expensive way to market to patients. If you have the eczema not controlled by anything else, your life might have been changed by a commercial. I'm not here to hold water for that. I think most some of those meds are miracle meds, right? Most aren't, but but at the same time, that is so not the problem relative to every time we do this. It's somebody else should change. Why isn't it doctor do this to lower the price of meds? Just have the website, even if you don't dispense the meds, look up the price of omeprazole and be like, it's $50 a month at the pharmacy. That does Walgreens yesterday settled a $100 million class action lawsuit because they were jacking up the price of insured, the cost of meds for insured patients over cash patients, right? The emperor's new clothes is that you think it's cheaper under insurance. It is always cheaper cash price. The only things that are unaffordable like this are things insurance is paying for, right? And so lower the cost of insurance, see how that brings down the cost of meds. I do this with my med students. Everybody just wants to shit on Big Pharma because it's popular. Even sometimes they're right. Usually I don't think they are. So is it ethical that the liver, the hepatitis C medicine is $1,000 a pill?
Is this a rhetorical question? Yeah, sounds like a trick question.
What do you think? Is it ethical or not ethical?
I don't know enough about that one. I we'd have to use something that I know something about.
Then just on its face.
Sure.
Even better. It's ethical?
I don't know. Doesn't sound ethical, no. But it's sure. No, it's fucking expensive.
It's not ethical. Pick a side, goddammit.
I say not ethical.
You're wrong. Absolutely.
Oh, fuck off.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. You're so wrong. It's embarrassing. No. I forget the name of it, but it's $1,000 a pill, right? 90 pills, 90 treatments, $90,000. It is a hepatitis C cure. And one time done, and the average cost to the VA to manage a hepatitis C patient per year is $140,000, right? So we love to shit on Big Pharma without perspective. It's a cure. They cured a disease. They could have easily charged way more for that, and it'd still be worth it. So we have to put a lot of this into context. Yes, the GLP-1s are amazing, interesting medicines that are horribly overprescribed by people who don't know what they're doing. And that abuse to it has led to all kinds of problems and the sarcopenic obesity that we're getting. And I think in particular, what physician who shall remain unnamed should be run over by a bus and then have their license removed because they're prescribing it to people with known eating disorders. You should go to jail. Full stop. It's a patient of mine. That's how I know. I have the patient with the eating disorder, and I know that they're getting it inappropriately. So in the same way, doctors need to control abusable meds. We don't do that with Xanax. We don't do that without, you know, the fact that you go off and get just the abusable med from a clinic that's not doing your primary care, your blood pressure, your blood sugar, your body dysmorphia, along with this, your, you know, protein intake, your exercise level, your post GLP-1 recovery, your DEXA to track, you know, this or titration. So this can't be done in context of just a one-time office-based or internet-based visit, right? It's, you know, and silly to charge more for that. I don't charge people more because they have a thyroid problem, right? And this, I really hate this about doctors. Like, oh, I'll do a membership model for $50 a month. But I really want to add weight loss. Well, that doesn't mean go to the gym with them. That doesn't mean spend an hour a week on education about nutrition with them. That just means I'm going to charge you more to prescribe the weight loss injection. Right.
Well, that's what the online things have done. That's what we, Spencer and I, have talked about a million times.
The patient should always be able to trust what the physician is saying. Like, that's bar none the most critical thing. Patients don't trust physicians right now because we haven't been trustworthy, right? And so we got to start being trustworthy to get back into that. But part of that is how we explain what the problem is. The problem is not marketing on TV. They'll still market. They'll just do it in a different way, a less transparent way, probably. PBMs would die overnight if doctors just did their job, right? We want the government to fix that? When was the last time, short of Doge, the government's going to fix anything, right? When we could do it right now, our Hippocratic Oath tells us to do it right now. Yeah, because if we just know the price, even if we don't dispense, then we can say, oh, well, your thyroid medicine is 4 cents a pill here, and it's, you know, 50 cents a pill at the pharmacy. What do you want to do, right? Well, I can't even afford my insurance, and I lost my job because somebody else was prescribed meds that were too expensive. These all have real impacts. And my partner, Dr. Doug, actually wrote an op-ed for our med school and got them to change their behavior. Because their continuing education lectures always talked about the most expensive medicines. And then two or three lectures later, they talk about how the cost of healthcare in America is so broken. How do you not connect? Don't start telling me, the family doctor, that the standard of care for all migraines is, you know, the $700 a month medicine, right? Because it may be the standard of care to the neurologist, but my patient can't afford it. And if my patient can't afford it, then I still have to, what's the next best thing, right? The problem with medicine that we keep starting with the newest, and they're great meds. They're great meds if you can afford them. But if you can't afford them, standard of care should start with some level of cost effectiveness, right? You know, and the fact that we don't. There's a great book, Free and Powerful Price of a New Economy. We've made DEXAs free. right? $300 test billed through insurance that never doesn't get done until you're 55, which is 10 to 15 years too late for your osteoclast because we can't. Because good business, electrolysis for aluminum foil and Christopher Columbus's egg and Michelangelo's rock, says we can find these solutions to have these amazing tools. I can do an EKG for free. I can do stitches for free. I can do all this. You could do diabetic education for free on a large enough scale, right? Shorter than that, it's $5 per month. Shorter than that, it's $10 per month, you know? And then, but if you're just doing a one-on-one dietitian to, that's going to be the most expensive, slowest way to do it. The problem isn't that you have those things. The problem is you got to see how to scale those to be the cost that meets the patient's needs, whether that's free or you're doing this podcast for free, mm-hmm. presumptively, yeah. maybe some protein yeah. powder.
So far.
I
haven't gotten any things. We're trying.
But you could just as easily scale these videos up. And, you know, there isn't a whole lot new in nutrition. Mm-hmm. And, you know, my Occam's razor is Umber's razor of healthcare. There's nothing accurate and interesting enough to sell on anywhere, right? Good medicine is just boring. No yeah, one has
that
a hack.
That is true.
You know,
that's why the quacks online make all the money,
right? Right.
They're trying to trick everybody.
The thyroid secrets they don't yeah. want you to know about, right?
Yeah, like classic.
That's the classic thing. So
you know, HRT. Getting all these hot, and there's always something that has hard to measure. Yeah. You know, blood levels or
always BS. And trust me, yeah.
I'm trying to rant on anything. So
yeah.
Well, we're at the hour mark, so we might as well wrap it up. What? So just you make sure you just tell everybody that my brother's a martyr and an asshole. I want to reiterate that.
I want to find a way to somehow compromise for these people because
like you're saying, just thinking about scaling using digital tools.
Another one of these and just map it out.
Yeah, like let's start
because we have plenty of endocrinologists doing this, but it's goal income. Estimated overhead, estimated patient panel size, divide by 12. That is, you know, the basis of it. Then the rest, how many dietitians do you want? You know, I have two registered nurses. Maybe you have a registered nurse and a dietitian. You know, you record videos.
It is about that size at first. I mean, we're going to have an MA. We're going to have a dietitian, diabetes educator, and me. And, and a virtual assistant, essentially, at first. So.
But then in a group phone call and what meds are, you know, can we get, and let's make that list. What meds can't we get? And then what are the alternatives? And you just keep breaking that down. We do that for each specialty.
Cool.
Let's go.
We're definitely going to need a part two and go over this. Oh my God. Yeah.
Jeez. So where can anybody find you? You are the Atlas MD. Where people find you?
Our website, atlas.md. And there's a live chat, my email, drjosh@atlas.md, hello@atlas.md. If you're interested in direct care, we offer all our consulting for free. We have a free lawyer, pharmacist, cardiologist, and radiologist to help direct care practices. Doesn't matter if you use our software or not, rising tides raise all ships. So primary care, specialty care, we help everybody. And we just want to see this movement put patients first and fix healthcare.
What an amazing guy.
Sweet.
Well, thank you for coming on. This is enlightening.
Yeah.
Especially if anybody can call my brother an asshole.
I got brothers who are assholes. We could all do, they work for me.
I knew it. I'm surrounded by assholes. Yeah.
I'm surrounded by assholes.
Cool. Thank you for coming on. Here's our outro.
Or not.
This podcast is for entertainment and education and information purposes only. Remember, the physicians on this podcast are not your physician. It should not be considered professional or personalized medical advice. It should not be used to replace speaking with your physician or medical professional to discuss your specific health concerns. The topics discussed should not be used solely to diagnose or treat any condition. As a result, we are not responsible for any unwanted medical outcomes. The views and opinions discussed are of those of the host only and do not represent those of any other entities. We'll be right back.